Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 25th, and it just happens to be Jubilee Day here at Holden. Now come listen to Gerhard Fischer, and he's continuing his series Reform of the Criminal Justice System with focus on the prison institution from a Christian perspective. This is session three. It's entitled The Journey to Reform of the Criminal Justice System. This is tape number FIG 2002-03. So now let's go and join Gerhard and the rest of the people.
One of the things I had to cut out, because as I said before, I had 5 hours. I was going to teach one day each week, every day each week. You know, and of course, about a week before he came, they told me they cut it to 3 hours. And one of those is today, which is not a very good time to be teaching because everybody's so tired and so much is going on. But anyways, one of the things I had to cut out was spirituality in prison, which I thought was a very, very good thing. It would have been good for this time of the year and what was going on. But I can't do it all, you know. Otherwise, I couldn't get to the part I really want to talk about, and that's reformation of the system. You know? Mm-hmm. But I want to tell you one thing that occurred at Oxford as far, and there were a lot of things that occurred there that I thought, because a lot of people... this was their first, you know, the first time they looked at God, you know, and while they were in prison. And others, of course, came and were, you know, fallen. Yes. It's okay. And so, you know, you had a whole conglomerate of different people who were there for different reasons, you know, for their penalties and so forth. But I found that for many, many people, God was very important in prison. Well, of course, you're lonely, and you know, so you do look at God a little more than you would, you know, when you're committing crimes, you know. But anyways, what I was coming to was, I had to cut out this section, but I would like to tell you about one thing that happened at Oxford. I think it was very, very good for me and everybody else that attended. The barber, he started a program called The Power of Prayer. And every night at 10 o'clock, they would make an announcement, and you would come to the chapel. And sometimes we had 5 people, sometimes we had 30 people, but they were, you know, all brothers and inmates. And they came, and we met in the chapel, and we formed a circle. No matter how big it was, we formed a big circle or a little circle. And then they began to pray. You know, I would pray for you because I heard your wife is sick. Or somebody would pray for my mother. You know, something happened to her. She fell and she hurt herself badly. So they start praying like that. And it would just go on and on. And people would pray for all kinds of things. I'm talking about felons, you know. These are people who, you know, have committed a felony. And there they are, all in a circle, praying, you know. And then... So they would go on until it became silent. You know, it might be 5 minutes, it might be 10 minutes. But then when it became silent, then we prayed the Lord's Prayer together, you know. And then we passed the peace. You know, and you know, with 30 guys. And these people talked about things in their prayer that they could not possibly talk about other people in prison. They, you know, they might be a laughing stock with some of them, you know. Mm-hmm. But there they were. And then, you know, some of the people stuck around for a while, and then finally when they had to go back to their rooms, you know. And what a wonderful way to end an evening, you know. Just think, for all the time I was there, every night at 10 o'clock I would meet in the chapel, like I say, with 5 people, 10 people, 20 people, 30 people, and share a prayer, and share the Lord's Prayer, and then pass the peace. Everybody hugged, and it was much better than most of our congregation. Yeah. If you were to do 25 people, everybody hugged everybody. Uh-huh. If it took 20 minutes, they hugged. You know, and these are men. Some of them there are for 10 years. We had one person there for 18 years. He had an 18 year. He didn't spend it all there. I don't know if he was in a maximum security or medium security before he came there. But he was a devout Catholic, and he played a guitar in the service, and he was one of those upbeat people, you know. I thought he was a short timer. He got 10 more days and he's out, you know. And then I said, how are you going to get out soon? And he said, no, I have 9 more years. I already served 9. But such a person, wonderful person. But there are all kinds of things I could have talked to you about the spiritual life in prison. But I have a more important thing.
I do have one question.
Yeah.
Were they willing to share their stories with you on a one-to-one?
You never, of course, never ask anybody why they're in. It's a forbidden, you know.
But you
can ask them how long. Oh, yeah, lots of people. I was the oldest man there, mm-hmm. you know, and I was there on a misdemeanor, not a felony.
And, did they know that without you telling them?
Well, they knew it because I passed around the material that I had regarding the School of America, you know,
oh,
I passed it around.
Okay.
And there were 20 lawyers there, as I told you yesterday.
Sure.
And of course, they were very interested in this trial. They said, what the hell are you doing here? You know,
sure.
for what we supposedly did, you know, civil disobedience. Well, anyways,
I have one question.
Yeah.
Now, that was where you were at in the minimum side.
Yes.
Does
right next door was a maximum.
Does something like that, as far as the service, go on at the maximum
no,
side?
No, I doubt it. They don't have that kind of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They have, you know, there's two chaplains, and they serve both prisons. And we had 180, and there's, I think, 1,300 in the other prison, my maximum security. And so that's a lot of people for two yeah. chaplains. You know, one was a wonderful woman who was a Presbyterian. I forget who the other the gentleman was. Nobody liked him because if you said you had a problem, they'd PT. Tell the prison authorities and you went in a hole.
Oh.
If you were disturbed or, you know, they always said for your own safety, you know. And she was so beautiful. She was, oh, everybody just loved her. She was a fragile woman,
yeah.
but she had the best sermons and his were kind of, he was a company man, you know. He really, you know, I had lots of pastors and their wives visit me, and he, if you asked him, he'd say no. If they asked the woman prison chaplain, she said sure, and she'd arrange
okay.
it. I had three, I could have had five visits, and they don't like that. They want the people to come on weekends with everybody else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, is that answer?
Yes, yeah. Thank you.
Okay, this is about reforming the system. Now, some people think it's quite good and they ought to keep it just the way it is. And my expertise does not become because I'm a criminologist, but my interest surfaced when I spent the time in prison, and I saw even in minimum security, and we also know people in maximum security prisons, and we visit people pretty regularly in those. So I gained a lot of knowledge, and I read at least 10 or 12 books on the subject, and all kinds of periodicals. I'm on all kinds of lists of material on their system and what we're trying to do. One of the things that, you know, makes me concerned is that we have become a very violent society. You know, I think we have the highest incarceration rate per capita in the whole world. We passed up Russia 2 years ago, and we have more people in prison per capita. We have over 700 people for every 100,000 people in prison. Another, although that makes 2 million, and then there's another 4 million who are in for parole or on probation. So there are 6 million people in the system. And, like I said, the next country in the Western world is Finland. They have 100 per capita,
mm-hmm.
and we have 700, you know. And not only that, we are also the number one exporter of arms. We, our prison system has been called in violation of the human rights of the United Nations, and a European Commission called our archipelago of prisons the most barbarous in the Western world.
Hmm.
We're the only nation still has capital punishment in the Western world. And all this together, I think, has some effect on the way we treat prisoners. We were not allowed, and in a minimum, we didn't get beaten up or anything like that, but I know that happens. Shawshank is not an aberration. You know, that's the kind of things that do go on in maximum security prisons. And the prisons are very racist and very elitist, you know. A lot depends on the prosecutor. It's gotten more so with the new laws, you know, truth in sentencing and three strikes. Some of the power has been taken away from the judges, and the prosecutors become even more, have more power than they ever had, you know. And the system, as I said, is based on status. And if you have status, you're not as likely to go to prison. You know. If you're a person of color, you're more likely to go to prison. And if you're rich, you can hire the lawyers. And we've had several cases in Wisconsin football players and so forth who were up for very serious offenses and got off.
Yeah.
And brought in, you know, they had four or five lawyers and brought in experts from all over the country because they had a lot of money. So everything, you know, in prison and in the system, the criminal justice system depends on money, status, and color. Who gets arrested, who gets tried, how hard people are tried, who gets convicted, and who goes to jail, and who gets the longest sentence depends on those things. I'd just like to say a word about white-collar crime. Do you remember the CEOs who represented the tobacco industry? Mm-hmm. And for year after year, they went before the Congress and lied.
Mm-hmm.
They had the information that people were dying, and 450,000 people die every year from effects of some kind of habit, from the smoking habit. They went before Congress every year and lied about the information they had, because they had this information many, many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Many, many, lots of lives could have been stopped. Would not have died had they told them, yes, we have evidence that it does kill people and you get emphysema and cancer, etc. These people have never gone to trial, have never experienced any time in prison, and they are the worst liars, and some of them, they cause more harm than all the murders and everything else that occurred in this country. You know.
So why not?
I don't know why not. I just know they appeared year after year, and there was always five of them sitting there, and I still see the pictures of these five executive CEOs sitting there. Oh, no, we have no evidence that it's harmful. Even recently, I think only two or three years ago, they once again testified. All the evidence was out. So I say that's one of those instances where money and status and et cetera gets you out of prison. You
know?
Or out of the system, actually. I want to talk about what I call the three R's of the prison system. The three R's. Retribution, or punishment. Rehabilitation, and release. First, about something about retribution. I have on here, where is it? Going to prison as punishment. Not going to prison to be punished, which is many of what our prisons do. They really punish people by violence and everything else, you know. But you really go to prison as punishment. And then, of course, that restriction and the long term and the conciseness of it. But you're not supposed to be punished. You're not supposed to be beaten or all these other things that sometimes happen. So, first of all, retribution. I believe in retribution. I think everybody says when you commit a crime, you should have some punishment. I mean, nobody would want you, if nobody ever got punished, what would we ever do about crime? It would just spiral, I assume, you know. And we have become very good at retribution or punishment in our systems. Much of it verges on vengeance and revenge. I think it's a very difficult thing to be a prison guard. I mean, it really is, because you get a lot of the emotion and the trauma of being in prison yourself, you know. So it's a very, very difficult, and it isn't paid very well. Prison guards don't make a lot of money. The most violent prisons, of course, the maximum security, they're very violent, and they're very racist, because everybody, and I don't mean just towards blacks. If you're in a community in prison, you have to stay with your people. If you're white, you gang with the whites. You know, if you're a supremacist, you find people of mutual ideas. If you're a Hispanic, you stay with your group. If you don't, you don't get the protection, and you can get in real serious trouble. And people don't know that. Who thinks that happens in prison? But it does.
Mm-hmm.
And I have word of people who have been in, and she's done a lot of visiting to prisons. The other thing that's so difficult in prisons is the criminal code. And that, I don't know if you know what that means. That means if you are in prison, there are certain things you do and certain things you don't do. And you have to learn that code, and it's very violent. It's a violent code. So it doesn't help you when you get out, you know, if you start using that code while you're in prison as a protection. You have to protect yourself, you know, so you have to. And I talk about people that I've talked to who have been in maximum security prisons, where that was the definition. You just had to go. It wasn't gangs, but it was different groups, you know, and some were more powerful than other groups. excuse me. I mentioned this before. Do any of you have Supermax prisons in your state?
Supermax. What's the definition?
I'll give it to you. Nobody even knows what it means.
I wouldn't know if we have it or not.
No. Well, we have. Texas has two or three, I believe, and we have one in Wisconsin, which I think is demonic. I don't know. Maybe anybody was here. I mentioned this last time. The prison cells are like from here to the wall, and maybe as wide as that. This wide as this. And in this area, there's a concrete slab. You have a little straw, a mat, in which you sleep, and you have a pillow. The lights are on 24 hours a day. There's a television in the corner that watches you 24 hours a day. You have a urinal and a hose. You get your meals to a slot. You're in that cell 24 hours a day. 3 days a week, they take you out for an hour. This is Wisconsin, and I know some of them even worse, maybe. Just for three hours a week, you get out of there, and you go into a room, which is probably from here to there, and it's also concrete, white concrete. There's no equipment in there, and you just can walk around in a circle. That's it for exercise. It's at least a little bigger than yourself. Mm-hmm. We had a lawsuit it first started with two criminals, then it became a class action suit for all the people at our prison. It's supposed to be for incorrigibles. Now, I assume there might be 20, 30 that, you know, commit crimes in maximum security or cannot be taken care of. They might have to go to something like that. Though I think they can be handled in a maximum security. They just go in a hole for a long period. But there's 500 beds in ours. And people who know, like district attorneys and so forth, and law officers say, you know, there are maybe 25 people who deserve that kind of treatment, maybe, because they will not tolerate, you know, any kind of order. We've got 300 beds in there. I know some of the people. I know their parents and why they're there. One was there primarily because he used to write letters, and he used to criticize the things that were going on in the prison he was in, and so he was sent to the Supermax. You know. Do you have a question? Oh, I know you're chasing a fly. So I think they're barbaric and they're demonic. You know. Psychiatrists say there's no way you can come out of a prison like that. You have to spend it from 14 months to 2 years in class one. After that, if you make it through that period, you go to class two, and you have no literature. They don't give you a Bible. You have nothing to read, and you lie in that or sit in that on your bed 24 hours a day, except for those 3 days when you go out. Well, Barbara Crabb was the federal judge who the case was presented against, and she ruled a whole screw of things. Like, first of all, she got rid of all people with mental illness, because he had six people in there who were definitely seriously mentally ill. And she said, we cannot have that in that purpose. They would just deteriorate even further, you know. In fact, I think psychiatrists say all of them are going to deteriorate under those conditions. You never see a guard, you know. They just give you your meal through a slot, and then that's it. Except when they open a cell, and then you can walk into the other area.
What about visitation?
You can visit, but you do it through a TV. The prisoner's taken to a TV, and the guests are taken to a TV, and then you speak over the TV. Yeah. There's no touching. See, that's part of this. No tactile thing at all. Nobody touches you for maybe up to 2 years. You know, that's hard. Nobody, you know. So that's Supermaxes, and of course we in Wisconsin, you know, it's so much against our tradition. We always had one of the finer penal systems in the country in the 80s. It was looked at as one that was very, very good, and then we have since become very reactionary. Our legislators have been, you know, have done some terrible things. Yep.
So that prison's fairly new.
It was originally a state prison. And at that time, we didn't need as many prisons, so they sold it to the federal government, the one I'm talking about.
Where is it?
It's in Oxford, Wisconsin. Oxford, Wisconsin. It's in the middle of Wisconsin. And it was a state prison, and, you know, 20 years ago or whenever they bought it, the federal government bought it, Wisconsin was not imprisoning everybody. We had so many people on parole, and it was a good system. And actually, people from the country, other places in the country, came to Wisconsin to see what was going on, because it was so heralded.
But I was referring to the Supermax, is that?
No, I'm talking about the prison system in Wisconsin. That Supermax, no, Supermax was built. That's brand new, and it's, I'd say 3 years, maybe?
I would say about five.
5 years,
when they had the open when they had the open house for the town, town people were glad it was there because it helped their economy.
Yeah, it was good for the
economy. When they had the open house, they gave away cups with Supermax on it and t-shirts.
Oh.
Yeah, you know, it almost was like a celebration.
Yeah.
It was, that's the way the town treated it.
Do you know how many there are in the country?
Oh, gosh, I think, I would say maybe, I'm not, again, I'm not a colonel, I don't know everything about this, but I would sense that maybe out of the 50 states, maybe 30 or 40 would have a Supermax. And so, like I say, Texas, I think, has three. Some of them are really old. Illinois had one similar to that way before they called them Supermax. That was Marion Prison. Mm-hmm. And they had the same kind of things in Illinois that are in the Supermaxes way, way back.
Mm-hmm. But you cannot read in those either.
Excuse me?
You cannot read. You have no reading material.
For the first 14 months, no, they have nothing. Now they have to have a Bible because of the decision by Judge Crabb. Wow. And she said, this is only the beginning. She said, I want this to come back again, and I want to start some other reforms in the Supermax. Yeah.
Now, so I grew up in Wisconsin. I remember Waupun. Is that still?
That's still a Supermax, a super, I mean,
a maximum.
Maximum security. It has a high wall around it.
Yeah.
And that's what, that usually identifies a super, maximum security one has a wall. The big, the oldest one is where we visit, I visited quite a few times, is up in Green Bay. And it's the Green Bay Reformatory. You know, they used to call them reformatories, you know, reform the guys.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit about the punishment or retribution, R number one. R number two is rehabilitation. And it's been my experience and experience of the people I visit, of people I've read, books I've read, etc., etc. I get periodicals all the time about prison life and what's going on in the prisons. Rehabilitation is very nil. There's very little that goes on. One thing that happens, I think, in especially in our national prisons, they do require GED. And so kids, young people have to get GED if they don't already have a college equivalent. So that's the only thing that I see as rehabilitation. And I give you a little idea. You know, you're in a super in a maximum security. Say you're in there for 10 years. You may have done something pretty serious. You know, you're in there for 10 years. You have to obey the criminal code. You know, that means violence and, you know, racism and all those things are part of your daily life for 10 years. And you have not increased your education any. Mm-hmm. You have not, just being away from society for 10 years, as quickly as society moves today, you know, the new things that occur. Can you imagine yourself coming out with, you probably went in with a fifth grade education or something like that, or maybe not even a high school, and you come out with nothing more than that. And In our jail, which is almost a medium security prison in Milwaukee, which just built for 1,200 people, when you get out, and that's what used to be the House of Correction and still is the House of Correction. I jumped ahead. That's release. But let me continue with rehabilitation. The only rehabilitation there was, if there was any, it was at Oxford in the minimum security prison, was what the prisoners did themselves. One man taught computers without a computer. He taught, you know, the basics without having a computer. And whatever you had as a skill, you could share it with the prisoners. And there was always some time in the evening to do that, you know. But in other prisons, you know, of greater security, I have to say, rehabilitation is not a priority. Many things were taken in Wisconsin. The Governor Thompson took a lot of stuff away that the wardens didn't want. They wanted, see, exercise, you know, late weightlifting, all, they say, oh, yeah, they come out there so strong. Or a lot of the wardens will say, it's good. It's something people focus on. Like in the prison where I was, a lot of the guys talked about, if you sit in a table with them, they're talking about, you know, I never lifted a weight in my life. But they talk about the cracks, you know, and if you're a weightlifter, you know what I mean. They have the, did you want to say?
Well, I was just going to say, the prison that we went to, I was telling Lucy this earlier, one of my first encounters was with a 19-year-old who was in there. And And he went to this weight room, and he was taking college credit classes that were offered there because he wanted to stay away from the TV room and places like that where people got in trouble. They'd get in big arguments and start fighting. And so when they took the weight stuff, you know, the weightlifting stuff and the classes away, that was just amazing.
The wardens were against it. 90% of the wardens like these things because it's like a carrot. Behave yourself and you can go with weights. If you don't, you can't, you know. So they didn't have anything to offer these people who, you know, got armory then, you know. But, yes?
Yes. Do the women have the same...
Of course, I'm no expert on women.
No, but do they have a maximum?
I don't know of any. I'm sure they have some that are bad, but I don't. They probably have some medium security prisons. Of course, we have the one near Washington, D.C., you know... Paulerson, you know, that's a women's prison, which is out in the boonies, and there's no place for people to come who visit, so a group of people of the church opened a house there so people could come there and stay, and they also provided a van which took people to Alderson, which was a women's prison, you know. And this was at least medium or maximum security prison. It was a very difficult place to be. That was right out of Washington, D.C., but it was not close enough. There was no bus service there, and so the church organized vans that ran on a regular basis and then bought this house where people could sleep, you know, and do that.
I think it's important for everybody to have a job in life, and I was impressed that there's so little work for prisoners to do.
Yeah, we have several we visit on a regular basis, and they can't find work. They're in state prisons, and... you know, you'd think, well, everybody should have a job of some kind, you know. We used to make license plates. I'm not sure we do that. Somebody else mentioned they make license plates in their state. But life is so lonely. I mean, you're so lonely, and it's so boring, and so a job is something that even you like. We made 16 cents an hour, you know. Mm-hmm. We had to work at, everybody had to have a job. So I taught GED, as I mentioned yesterday. But that would be at least something, you know. But I think the length of sentences are so long now and are increasing, and that length of stay and then no rehabilitation, at least very little. There are some exceptions. Some wardens are wonderful wardens, but as soon as they leave, the whole system goes back to some other warden's idea of what it should be, you know. But anyways... That's a bit about rehabilitation, which is, I think, is very negligible.
Hasn't some of the unions and stuff really fought putting prisoners to work because it takes a job?
Well, if the government decided they wanted people to work, we have UNICOR. Anybody know what UNICOR is? That's a federal program, and it was certainly in our prison. We had one plant in the minimum security, one in the maximum security, and it was the government, and they started with 50 cents an hour, you know. So they were very competitive, and they did defense industry or offensive industry, if you want to, material. They put electrical circuits together that were used in the defense industry. I have something I could tell you, but I won't because I can't substantiate it, but it was... A lot of people like to work there because it broke your day up. I mean, you had a regular 7-hour day, you got up in the morning and you went to work, you know, and then you saw them coming home at 7 hours later and they ate there and so forth. And they were treated well, and it passed the time, you know. Time went a lot faster when you're working and doing what you think is at least something that's productive, you know. So that was a good thing, but I have some real negative things about it also, but a lot of it is, and it wasn't the unions that said you can't work, no. If the federal government says we're going to have UNICOR, and the unions would have nothing to say about it. They would just say that's what we're doing, and they do. They're in most federal prisons.
Connected to the unions, I think in general the labor movement is critical of it because of the wage level.
Yeah, 50
and
cents
that
an hour.
If you try to pay people that anywhere else, you know, people be off, you're exploiting these people.
That's,
you know,
and it's very, they're very competitive, of course, because of the, you know, what they produce at these minimum wages. I would suggest that something I thought about in reform would be to pay at least a minimum wage. And it doesn't go to their, some of it would go to their room and board, and some would go to their family, sent to the family, and others would be put in reserve when they get out. And they'd split it up like that, and some would go to, and they could pay them $8 an hour or whatever it is, because they're competing, they're still competing, even at $8 an hour, you know. Anyways, that's unicorn. You may hear a lot more about that in your lifetime. The third thing is release, and I think this is what we do really badly. There's no, in every state prison in Wisconsin, there's a beautiful mission statement on the wall as you come in. And it talks about rehabilitation, we're going to do all these things for these people, and of course they don't. They also talk about, we want them to go back into society as good citizens. And it doesn't work. The recidivism rate is so high because, think of it, you know, like I said, to say, you're in there 10 years, you don't get any much education, you become bitter in many cases because of the system and so forth. And then you go out and in a lot of prisons, including, I was saying, the House of Correction in Milwaukee, what happens to you when you get out, you're taken on a bus at midnight to downtown Milwaukee, winter or summer, and you have the clothes you came with you when you went in. A lot of the Christian organizations tried to give them coats and stuff in case they came out in winter, and you came in on summer with shorts, you know, or something. They take your clothes away, of course, and then you get it back when you leave. And they would, and I know this in many prisons that they take you, because I work with a woman who runs an agency for release, and she knows that this happens in almost all the prisons. You get, and you know, it used to be $40 in a suit, you know, and you don't get a suit anymore, you get the clothes you came with, and you don't get the $40 anymore, but you get a bus ticket to where you came from in many prisons, you know. So, there's nothing to prepare people for release. They come out, and there are many people in prison who have lost, and I've got some statistics here, I guess, 85% of people in maximum security get a divorce. Well, I can imagine the women, he's got a 10-year sentence, you know. I mean, not many women can stick around for 10 years. And 50% never have a visit. 50% of people in maximum security never have a visit. 33% who do have visits have one a month. And then you come out from that kind of a system, kind of alone, nobody out there to help you. We have a wonderful program in Milwaukee called Project Return. And it's a wonderful program. It helps people who come out of prison, our state prisons, and they will stick with you for as long as you want them. They'll provide clothes, they'll provide food, they'll help you find a place to live, they'll do all these things that you need to, first of all, they help you get a job. They'll send you to various places who have been cooperative and take the felons. And so that is one of the, and their recidivism rate, if you stick with that, with Project Return for 1 year, the recidivism rate is 2%. Mm-hmm. 98% who have done it for a year go on and stick it out, you know, and they become good citizens. But that's the exception. There are no other of these kind in all of Wisconsin. I don't know any place where there is what they call a Project Return. People who care about people. They go to prisons and say, when you get out, come, and you're coming to Milwaukee, look us up, you know. Now, I think, you know, this is another figure that is devastating. Where is it? 630,000 inmates are being released. You know, we've got 2 million plus all the people on parole. It's a constant turnover of people, and they come in communities, maybe by 1,000 in some of the big cities, and have nothing to do. There's no jobs for them. It's even harder for a person who's got a college education or a high school education and some training to get a job. So prisoners are, of course, way down on the totem pole. Some things that have affected, you know, prisons has been three strikes. Are you familiar with that? You know, there have been some real abuses of that. You know, where somebody has two crimes, and then the third one was stealing a set of videos, and then you go to for life. You go into a life, and you know, the third strike is life imprisonment. The other thing is mandatory sentencing, and also that does restrict it a bit with the judge, but mandatory sentences, it doesn't mean that. But if the crime calls for 10 years, you stay in for 10 years. There's no parole anymore. in these kind of cases, they're mandatory that you stay the 10 years. And it has meant that the sentences have not been reduced because of that. So people stay a lot longer in prison, and they're growing in leaps and bounds. I mean, if things continue as they are, I don't know what the prediction for 2005 is, that we'd have 4 or 5 million people in prison instead of 2 million. So that's going to be a real problem, and it's an ongoing problem that's going to get worse if we don't our budget for the prison system in Wisconsin, because we built so many prisons and we have so many people in prison, is over $1 billion for the first time, you know, over $1 billion for the first time. And that you know, and we have over a billion dollar deficit, you know, that we were not able to solve. We used all the tobacco money. Remember all the money that states got from the tobacco companies? We used it all to patch up that $1 billion deficit. And the criminal justice system, the prison system, is just skyrocketing as far as costs, you know, and spending more and more money. And there are some positive things that are happening. I was very elated to hear the Supreme Court ruled that people with mental illness could not be on death row. I don't remember that. It just happened recently. You know, those are positive. We're finally putting people to death who are mentally retarded or have other illnesses. The other program that we were pushing very hard, and anytime you want to leave, you can leave. I don't know what time you want to. I think the Vespers are at 6:30. Mm-hmm. But it's called TIP, Treatment Instead of Prisons. California is doing it, Arizona's doing it, and Hawaii is doing it, and other states are considering it. In Wisconsin, we figure we could save $10 million a year if we put people into healing or treatment instead of sending them to prison. It costs about $5,500 for a year of treatment if you have a drug problem. This is for first-time or second-time offenders who have not used hard and have not been big buyers or sellers, you know. That's who we'd be for. And in that, with that years of treatment, we also would include some form of education, so that people grow in their educational values and so forth. You know, it doesn't mean everybody who goes in that program comes out and is a good guy for the rest of his life, but it does mean that there's a good chance that they'll have something going for them when they get out, or they won't even go in. The program, if they get through the year of treatment, they don't have to go to prison. Of course, if anything happens and they do something, of course, they go back, and the original offense is part of what they will then face. But it costs $25,000 to $30,000 to put a person in prison. It costs $5,500 to treat them. So there's a lot of justification. So I think it's a good program. And our faith-based organizing, I wish somebody would come up here and teach that sometime. I think it's a wonderful thing if you haven't got it. But it's faith. We have 45 congregations in Milwaukee with people who have been trained for how to use the power we have. As we've probably got 30,000 people in those congregations, you know, and we have passed some wonderful, wonderful things on the basis of having that power, and it's a good power. You know, and power can be good. I just want to say a couple words about restorative justice. Is it a word anybody has not heard? Restorative justice? Raise your hand if you have never heard of restorative justice. Have you all heard about it at all? It's something, you know, some of it came out of New Zealand, and it came to the United States. And what it is, we have a restorative, one of the kinds of things we do in Milwaukee, the district attorney has a full-time assistant district attorney who works on this program. And what it is, I'm a facilitator, I've had 14 cases now, or 12 cases. And what happens is we get the victim and we get the offender and we visit with each one of them, try to find what are the facts, what impact has it meant, and how can we fix this up. Then we get them together. We get them together in a room, and there are people from the community there. As a facilitator, you cannot do anything but run the show. You know, you can't say, well, you ought to do this or you ought to do that. You just facilitate. But the people from the community, they're the ones who are angry. You know, you think that you just hurt this woman, you hurt the whole community. You know, they get on them, you know, on the perpetrator. And we've had a lot of felony cases that were settled. We had one which was that I participated in, that was a forgery, and that's a felony. And the victim was willing to have it dropped to a misdemeanor, and they happened to be two lawyers who did a stupid thing. They threw their check stubs in the garbage can. Their old checks they didn't use, they threw them in the garbage can. And these people found them and used them to cash in the bank. And, but anyways, that's what we do. We sit down. I've got one when I get back. We're going to have the conference. And we have these two meetings with these people. Then we have the conference. And what happens is everybody speaks who wants to. And of course, they have lawyer representation. The lawyers aren't there to do much because this is not a court trial. And it's everything is confidential. And if the victim says I want my money back, I'd like a letter of apology, and I'd like to have them have some community service. And then we look at the offender and say, is that okay with you? And of course he has to agree. But if he doesn't agree, the case goes back to the judge then, and it's treated as a regular case. Mm-hmm. If we can come up with an agreement, then that agreement goes to the judge. And the judge in almost every case so far has said amen, and then if you, and then we have somebody who monitors that, a person who does that, you know, monitors, are they paying it every month like they're supposed to? Have they sent the letter that they said they would about their apology? Are they doing the community service? And once they break the code or they break the agreement, then it's back to prison, back to the judge, and then they are treated as any other person. If they do the agreement, the case is wiped out. You have it on your record that you appeared, but there's no conviction, and it's wiped out. Mm-hmm. And then you don't go to jail, or you don't do this. And I've had 12 cases. Six have come back where all agreements were held, and the perpetrator was okay, did everything he was supposed to do, and then in that case with the forgery, there were three young men involved. One of them went to the Marines. If he had been convicted of a felony, he couldn't go to the Marines. Another one wanted to go back east where he lived with his mother and dad, and if he had to stay in jail, it would have been a whole lot different, you know. And I forget what the other person was trying to do too. He was also going to move out of Milwaukee. But it's been my experience that that's a good program. I've got some material there if you want to take it and look at it in your community, if you'd like to do something like that. In our case, it took the legislator to approve the budget to allow two district attorneys in Wisconsin to do this. One is in Madison and one is in Milwaukee. And I highly accord that it's something we should be doing. And it's a positive thing. And I believe, you know, that you like to think that the Christian community would be involved. You know, I said this, I think I said it the other day, and I don't know if you heard this before, but in Matthew 25, there are six edicts that Jesus refers to. You know, when the people say, well, when did I ever do that to you? Or, you know, when didn't I do that for you? Well, that's feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, you know what they are. And the sixth one is visit people in prison. And that's the one I think we do the least. I think the other ones we do pretty well. We're hospitable, we take people in, and you know, we do those things very well, pretty well, I think, as a good. And I must say, of all the people who, faith groups who work in prison, I would say the Lutherans are on the back end of it. You know, I find the Baptists and some of the other ones are much more, you know, doing, and the ones who do the most, guess who are who? Islam, yeah. Because they don't have pastors who have to come in. Somebody who's an Islam, a devotee, he starts a group. And almost every, like at Oxford, we have maybe 15 guys that were met every day or did the prayer thing, you know, did all those things. And they were former Catholics, former Lutherans, who now were Muslim.
Well, you said something about pastors having to do it. Well, I mean, they don't have to be pastors, but I know I have a friend who works with women's ministry in the prison, and she's not, I mean, she's a lay person, and she works with, you know, Chuck.
No, I'm not, I didn't say they have to be pastors. I said they don't need pastors.
Oh, okay.
You know, we had Bible classes and things where people came in to teach them in the evenings, you know, whether they were Baptists or so. No, you can have a prison ministry, one of our best prison ministry, I forgot to bring copies, I guess. But she sends out a newsletter every called Soul Food, and she does it every month, and it's got all kinds of good things in it. And she has visited people at the Maximum Security, at the Supermax, and she has a host of people that she visits continually. She's a Lutheran person, and she's now got people that support her and do the same thing, you know. But my observation, if you go to, when I went to revisit at Green Bay, you know, the Maximum Security there, on a given day, you know, you're supposed to be there from 12 to 4. That's the visiting hours. And this is a prison of 10, 15,000, I don't know, it's a big prison, you know. And there may be 25 people that come and visit, you know. And when you come there, it takes forever to get through, because you have to go through all that. Mm-hmm. You know, they look you over, and it takes an hour. You're there at 12 because you want to get in right away, you know. At 1 o'clock or 1:15, and sometimes even later than that, you finally get up to see your person, and he's not there yet. When you get through, then they call him. So that make another 10 minutes for the guy to walk up there to get to visit you. And then at 3:45, they say, that's it, folks. You know, everybody start going for the exits, you know. So a 4-hour visit is 2.5 hours, maybe, you know. And these are people who come from a long way. You know, they can't do this every day, or every week even. You know, they have to get help. Some people don't have cars. They have to have somebody drive them up there. So that's another detriment to, you know, to helping prisoners become good citizens, you know. I just want to give you one statistic. People say, well, if you're in prison, you deserve to be there. And especially since it's such a racist thing that, you know, there are so many people of color, especially Afro-Americans. We're losing a whole generation of Afro-American males. And especially in the voting sphere, because many states you can never vote. In Wisconsin, if you get off parole, you can finally vote then. But we're losing a whole group of Afro-American people, you know, especially males. And what was I going to say?
Statistic. They belong there.
Hmm?
They committed a crime, they belong there.
Yeah, that's what people say. And a lot of people say, well, put them in and throw it away, key, you know. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you what these are national statistics. And they say, especially people who say, well, black people commit more crimes, they should be in prison more. And it's about 85% of people in prison are people of color. Listen to this statistic. 14% of the people who commit drug crimes are African males. Remember that figure. 35% of the people who get arrested for crimes are drug crimes are Afro-American males. I think it's 55% of them go to trial. Of all those who go to trial, 55% of those are African males, males. 75% of the people who go to prison for drug-related crime are Afro-American. So we go from 14% to 75%. You tell me if that sounds like something that should happen. And this is a Department of Justice statistic for the whole country, national thing, where from 14% of the people who are taken in because they committed a drug crime, that goes to 75% of African males go to prison. And you can check me out on that. It comes out of the Department of Justice.
It's really coming out on the flip side of that, too. I mean, you keep talking he and your experience with men in prison, that you had commented about the dollars and the income. Yeah. In state of Michigan, where I'm from, if a father goes to jail, child support stops.
Yeah.
It doesn't even accrue. There's absolutely no support given to mothers or their children. And statistically across the board in the United States, African-American women and with children are the poorest. And that is, a lot of it's related to the lack of child support and is, in terms of interrelated features, affected to the drug, the prison culture that affects the African-American community.
I in there I have a piece about how much poverty has to do with people going to prisons, and you should read that. People don't debate me on that, but that's what I think happens. People who go to prison are used, many of the people who go to prison, except for the rich, that don't go but are convicted, are people who have been in abject, many times abject poverty, who have no education. I'm sorry, you have a question?
I came in late, but I don't know whether you covered it, but prison is after the fact. Now, if we backed up in our nation and did something before those people went to prison, what could it be?
Well, I was just talking about treatment. I don't know if you heard that. For drug, you get caught with some marijuana, maybe the second time they put you in prison or jail. And we're advocating treating those people, getting them off the drug habit, instead of going to prison, instead of filling up our prisons. I mean, we're just going to skyrocket with the number of people in prisons.
I was going to say that when we've been going, the number of Spanish-speaking people has increased greatly.
Oh yeah.
In prison.
Yeah.
I would say that we saw and worked with as many Spanish-speaking people as we did Afro-American.
Well, I think, you know, they're the fastest-growing minority by far. I mean, they're just skyrocketing in California. They're going to be a majority number of people in California in you know, 10 years or longer. But, yeah, it's true. And women also are going more and more to prison. You know, there are lots of more, you know, that used to be an exception, a woman who went to prison. I never knew anybody, any woman. Or I knew a lot of men who did, but never any women. But that's changing. That's growing in leaps and bounds, and women are going more and more to prisons, you know. So.
You know, it seems to me that along with prison reform, that the judicial system needs reform.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the inequities, you know, you hear about people being sent to prison for long terms for some of these minor crimes.
Absolutely.
And where, like you see, the white collar crimes are getting all the slack.
Well, the white collar crimes probably cost us 10 to 20 times of all the robberies, all the bank holdups, et cetera, et cetera. And I give the figures. We're talking about billions of dollars that are lost by white collar. We've got a whole slew of them. You know, and you wait till see if these people from Enron are ever going to go to prison.
Yeah.
Let's see if they go. And I still talk about that, the wife of one of them, the head guy.
Yeah.
And she said, we lost one of our homes. I had six of them.
Right.
You know, it's getting so terrible. I mean, I don't know what we're going to do. We have to go to welfare.
So
but anyways, that's the thing. White, do you have a question? Oh, did you raise your hand?
Yeah. I think this elitism needs to go, like this thing about rich people not going if they get into trouble.
Mm-hmm. Did you understand what you're saying?
The rich people need to go.
Oh, Benny,
yeah.
I always say there are a lot of people in prison who shouldn't be there, and there's an awful lot more who are not in prison who should be there.
Mm-hmm. Rich have too good.
Excuse me?
Rich have too good,
Well, you know, you can imagine. You know, you're, as I said the other day at Oxford, in a minimum security, we had several aldermen from Chicago, we had two mayors, and we had, you know, they went to minimum security, you know, and they defrauded their situation. And if you were here, I told you about the father and son that were at Oxford, and they had committed, this was organized crime. They were big contractors, and some of you heard it. But they were caught for poor manufacturing. The roads would roll up, and they were brought to trial, and they were convicted, and they were fined $42 million, and they paid it in cash. And they spent some time in a minimum security prison.
I just wanted to ask your opinion of Chuck Colson. I hear so much about prison.
Yeah, I've read his books, and I'm glad he's doing what he's doing. I don't think he has the total answer. I think, you know, he does, I don't know, I shouldn't judge what he does because I don't know enough about it. But it's not the answer we really need. You know, I think it's good that, and there should be more of those kind of programs. It would be good. But we've got to have something that's more universal Every state ought to have something, and the national government should have something to, first of all, get away from the vengeance and the revenge and try to help people who are in prison. Even a person who's, well, what's the big statistic that just blows your mind today? 101 people have gone off a death row.
Yeah.
Because they were now proven innocent. Mm-hmm. One man was, I think, was in within 36 hours of dying with the injection. And then they found out that he was innocent because of DNA. And the people who started that were students and professors at Northwestern University. Just think, they start a trend for what we've got in Wisconsin now. We've got all over the country, people are doing these innocent projects and checking up on people. You know, maybe this guy's innocent, let's check it out, you know. And more and more. And when you say, and just in this short time, over 100 people have been released, think of all those who probably died who were innocent, you know, over the course of the last 10 or 20. We are the only Western country that still has capital punishment. Nobody else does.
Do you think that will be used to as a justification for getting rid of it?
I would hope so. I would pray it would. I would pray that it would be stopped, you know, but...
Does the ELCA have a social stance against capital punishment?
Yes, and we introduced it to our state, to our Senate, and we took it on to the Assembly.
Yeah, there's I know that I work with the Lutheran Office of Governmental Ministry in New Jersey that is advocately supporting the moratorium.
Yeah.
And I think
That would be good if we had a moratorium for a few years, and then made sure we weren't putting people to death who were innocent, you know. But there are so many things, and I know there's a lot of priorities, but I think if we don't do something about the prison situation, it's going to escalate. It's the cause of our big shortage of money in Wisconsin because we put so much money into prison. We have a prison we built, and we didn't build it. A private enterprise built Stanley Prison in Stanley, Wisconsin. They wanted $83 million for it. They did it without anybody's permission. They built it, and they said, would you buy it? And we paid the full $83. We could have said, we'll pay it 5 cents on a dollar, you know, or 10 cents on a dollar. Or what are they going to do with that prison? What are they going to do with it? They did it without asking. And so now we don't have enough money to put people in prison because we've got this major deficit. We also have in Wisconsin the most people out of state, you know, of any state. Yeah. At one time we had 5,000, it's come down a little bit. And Stanley Prison is sitting there empty, and they've got, they had six people who worked there. Now the state senator from Stanley got, when they did the budget, he said, I'm going to vote against it unless you provide 75 jobs for Stanley, which isn't even going to open. So they did that. They put that into the budget for 75 more officers who are going to sit there. Maybe they'll clean the place or something. I don't know. But they are there, and we're going to pay for them, you know. And that prison will not open for at least another year, probably. And it's just going to sit there empty, and they'll turn the lights on in the morning. And
Just talking about the dollars involved, what was appalling to me in a book that I had read was that it's actually really big business, and that will have expos, prison expos of like the newest things that you can buy to put into your prisons. I mean,
we have private prisons which have failed.
Yeah.
In Arizona, I think they had some, and they just said, no, it doesn't work. Well, you've been so patient, you've stayed over.
One more question.
Yeah, go ahead.
What's the percentage of people in prisons that are addicted, or, you know, that their crime is related to addiction?
The vast majority. The vast majority are drug crimes. And, you know, sending bombers down to, or helicopters down to Colombia to spray those fields and infect many of those peasants is not going to solve the problem of people selling cocaine in Milwaukee and Chicago or Washington. That's not going to cut it at all. But Dow Chemical, who produces the product that they're using to spray, is part of what they use for spraying.
Roundup.
They added some very, very bad stuff to that, and they sold the federal government into using it, and they spray it all over, and they think that's going to stop the production.
Last I knew, they had stopped that.
Well, they had, because so many people were ill.
Technically, it was written up in the legislation that that whatever was used for spraying had to be EPA approved, which is not.
No. No, they still use it for a long time, and people were breaking out with sores, and they spray it indiscriminately. You know, a lot of it goes into other fields. But really, what they really, if they really want to stop people from using it, from growing cocaine and coca, pay the money. The $1 billion that we sent down, over $1 billion in aid for this last year for Colombia, use that to help those people convert to something more productive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is much higher than growing vegetables. They make more money selling coca.
The same is true in Afghanistan right now.
Yeah, right. Well, that's coming back. The Taliban at least kept it down a little bit. You know, but it's back to where it was. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Take one of those. Yes. Anything else you say?